You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 17th to the 23rd of April 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, editor John Gill and reporter Jack Grove. Which universities are awarding more firsts and 2-1s than expected? It might not be the institutions you expect. That's our splash this week. The NUS has a new vice president for higher education. She's been talking to Jack Grove about putting improving access to postgraduate education at the heart of her first term in office. And this week's cover feature analyses university accounts to see how they performed in the first full year of operating under the 9K fees regime. It's our annual HE financial health check, and John will tell us a bit more about that soon. But first, the lead news story, Simon. A report shows which universities are awarding more firsts and 2-1s than might be expected based on student background.
Yeah, that's right. The whole report wasn't really looking at these figures. It comes in an annex to a Hefke report. There were some very interesting figures that we found about 2-1s and firsts and the proportion that get those. But it's quite statistically a bit complicated, but what these figures kind of show is that if you account for various different background factors like school qualifications, social background, the type of school that person went to, gender, ethnicity, all that kind of thing. Accounting for that, then these figures show that there were a number of institutions that had more 2-1s and firsts than you would expect, and there were a number that had less. The sort of total was about 21 that had more than expected and 18 that had fewer than expected.
Yeah, we've outlined them there. I mean, some of the ones that had more, just for the record, Brunel, Coventry, Exeter, Hertfordshire, Kingston, those who were awarding fewer than expected, Bath, Goldsmiths, Imperial College. It's an interesting list.
And you shouldn't jump to conclusions about this and say, oh well, that basically shows that, you know, this is a mark of kind of that standards are falling in some way, because it could just show that in the case where there's more 2-1s and firsts than expected, that, you know, the teaching is excellent, basically. Mm. And, you know, and that's kind of the response that we've got in some cases. But it does show, I think, if you look overall, and while I wouldn't want to single out sort of particular institutions for this story, really, I think what it shows is that, you know, and this is a constant issue in the background of HE, is can you compare degrees? Can you compare 2-1s at first? Is the 2-1 or first from one institution the same as another institution? Because obviously they all, you know, design these degrees themselves, and, you know, is there a way of comparing them at all? And if there's vast variation, you know, you start to question whether is there a problem here? You know, is comparability really possible?
I think it's one of those questions that's been bubbling along for as long as there's been a higher education sector, probably. The simple truth is that you can't have a completely homogenous approach to degree classification, and you never get complete comparability of degrees. There was a Hefke report a few years ago written by Roger Brown, in which he said actually it's impossible to get complete comparability, and it may not even be something that, you know, would particularly be you know, good for the sector. But so you shouldn't perhaps get too hung up on that fact. But certainly it's, you know, we have had other indicators over the years that there are inconsistencies, and
contact time was one we did recently, isn't it? The amount of contact time on different degrees. It'd be interesting to map those findings against.
It would be. Again, a Hefke and Witch study, which found really quite dramatic differences in the amount of time that different groups of students work to get their degree. So I think, you know, even if you take something that you would imagine students would work fairly similar workloads to achieve a degree like medicine and dentistry, Hefke found in that case that the hardest working university, if I can put it like that, students worked an average of 49.8 hours a week, and at the least hard working university, the same student studying the same subject studied for 32.7 hours. I mean, it's a huge difference, and does tell you something about the inconsistencies that there are within the sector.
There are also incentives as well to increase the number of 2-1s that you award apparently, if you do so, you it's a category in lots of league tables run by newspapers. So the more 2-1s that you award, supposedly, the better the university you are. And there have been edicts that come from on high saying we need to improve the number of 2-1s that we're giving out, increase the number of 2-1s we're giving out, because we're below average in this respect.
So. And I think it's probably quite rare that you get a really explicit, you know, the game plan that it goes on as far as league tables are concerned often is implicit rather than explicit within institutions, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although we have had one or two stories over the last few years where there have been some really quite dodgy goings on within specific departments, haven't we?
Yes.
Yeah, without naming any names. I mean, I think it is. I think that point that Jack makes is really interesting about the league tables. Because you can begin to, while I can't concede that it must be really very difficult or impossible for an edict to sort of specifically say we need more of these types of degree without that someone blowing a whistle on that and saying, well, what's going on here? You know, you can see a virtuous circle of, well, if you can get more 2-1s or first, you go up, and if you then go up the league tables, then of course you will get, you know, more students applying, possibly better students. So you know, you can see how that might, but what, you know, what, there's absolutely no evidence to say that actually happens.
Also, if you want to improve your employability statistics, if you're giving a very low number of your students 2-1s, then that won't help
it's
them
true,
when they go out into the
yeah, and that's a complete,
apply for jobs.
That's a completely bog standard cut-off point for a lot of employers, isn't it?
Yeah.
A 2-1 now. It's like, you know, if you don't have the 2-1 on your CV, it just gets chucked in the trash can.
Unfortunately, you can see a situation where you might have a cohort of students 1 year who, you know, they may all be of a 2-1 standard, but do you then have to give some people a 2-2 and a third just to make sure the standards are maintained? You shouldn't do, really, should you? But at the same time, you know, there might be pressure on them to do that to show that there are the standards being maintained. But it's it's a very interesting area.
It is, yeah, and of interest to students as well as staff, of course. Jack, you were speaking of students up at the conference of the National Union of Students last week. Was it last week or before that? Up in Liverpool. What did you bring back from there?
Well, it was a very interesting couple of days up in Liverpool. And Megan Dunn was elected. She's the president of Aberdeen University's Student Union. Quite interesting, she's an English student from Manchester, but she went to university in Scotland, so she's had to pay lower fees.
She's been elected to vice president for
She's now vice president for higher education. She's taken over from Rachel Wenstone. It's a very key position because Tony Pearce is the president. She hasn't been to university, and she has tended to talk about further education, while Rachel Wenstone, the predecessor to Megan Dunn, was the chief spokesman for higher education. So it'd be interesting to see whether Megan Dunn takes on this role. Megan Dunn will say that she wants to do a lot more for postgraduates. She said that postgraduate study was too often viewed as a middle-class playground, and she wanted to smash through the layer of privilege that dominates postgraduate study. She didn't exactly say how she wanted to do this, but following the election, there is going to be a big push to see if an alternative funding model, perhaps sort of state-sponsored funding model for postgraduate, might come into effect.
And something similar to the undergraduate model.
Yeah, well, David Willetts has said this is something he wants to see done, but
I mean, that's
there's a few details on this at the moment.
It's a stubborn
problem. She'll be involved in it, and she's, you know, saying this is going to be a key priority for her.
I think it's about time that was really got to grips with. It's quite absurd. That's been, you know, 2 or 3 years now that we've been writing about this issue. It's been blindingly obvious to all concerned that, you know, it's really going to hammer postgraduate numbers. I think we had a Hefke chief executive talking at an event just today where she said that only a quarter of taught postgraduate students in the current cohort are UK. The rest are all international students. I mean, it's quite extraordinary what's happened to that.
Yeah.
So I think the NUS are absolutely right to try and get to grips with this. And David Willetts, you know, he may say that it's an area he's concerned about, but he has known about this problem for quite some time, and all the government's focus has been on the full-time 18-year-old undergraduate. Yeah. And actually, Liam Byrne, who I chaired a debate, Liam Byrne was speaking out a couple of weeks ago, and he was quite explicit about Labour's intention to get to grips with this as well, and said that you know, it was his intention that a Labour government would bring postgraduates into the loan system that covers undergraduates currently.
Yeah. I mean, part of the problem is that it's not really something that will necessarily win you lots of votes, is it?
No.
Talking up postgraduate education.
No, but that doesn't mean it isn't hugely important.
Absolutely.
For the economy, for universities, for all sorts of, and for social mobility, as suggested in your piece.
I'd also just like to say there's an interesting figure who was also elected called Piers Telemach, and I advise you to go on YouTube and watch his speech, because it's absolutely brilliant. He's a guy from Bradford, and he really tells it like it is. He did part of his speech in a sort of rap poem style. And
care to do the same thing?
Well,
for us,
I can't really do his Bradford accent justice, because it was a really inspiring speech, and he was really the underdog, and he came, no one had really heard of him before this speech, but he absolutely blew everyone away, and he romped home to take the to become the vice president for society and citizenship. So I think he's definitely one to look out for.
Reminds me of last year, where one of the president's candidates was an inanimate carbon rod. It was actually a guy who made an incredible speech the annual conference. Also on our podcast page, actually, if you search back to April of last year, 2013, you'll find that there. But we must move on now. The cover feature this week, John, we'll come back to you. It sees John Morgan, who isn't here, analysing university accounts. It's our annual financial health check of higher education institutions, compiled by Grant Thornton, the data in this one. It's always a big story for us.
Yeah, and I regret that John Morgan isn't here, because it's a very complicated story too, so it'd be nice for him to grapple with it rather than me. This is an annual fixture. We do this financial health check in collaboration with Grant Thornton, the accountant, who go through all the financial accounts of the universities and pull out the interesting figures that show how institutions are faring financially. And I won't go into the detail of the individual institutions, but there are some sort of headline figures that seem to have come out of this. And one is that there's been a slight dip in university surpluses in the year we're looking at, which is 2012-13.
The second year running, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually the conclusion that Grant Thornton draw from that is that they think that this appears to show universities starting to dip into the fairly large surpluses that they've built up, especially with the introduction of £9,000 fees. To start to spend money on things like estates, campus improvement facilities, all those things that it was expected, you know, students would demand more of as they came through with higher fees.
And that ties in actually to our second feature this week, which does look at how unions themselves have sort of come to rely to an extent on funding from the universities, and then the universities that are sort of building impressive buildings and facilities, and the changing face of the student union too.
Yeah, and given there's been such a massive decline in capital funding available from government, you know, this is where universities have to go if they want to spend money on this stuff. So, no, it's really interesting. I mean, various vice-chancellors quoted in the piece, John Cater at Edge Hill saying that if he looks in his crystal ball, he thinks that the outlook for universities financially is fairly gloomy medium term, and actually this is a period, you know, when they do have quite significant fee income coming through the door, you know, before £9,000 cap is eroded by inflation and so on. Actually, they need to be making hay to a certain extent while the sun's shining.
Mm-hmm. But they always say that, don't they? They're never going to say there's loads of money, everyone can have a pay rise. They're spending on this year, they're going to be spending £3.9 billion on capital infrastructure, and everyone knows you need to have a bit of a war chest to sort of protect against the bad times, but I suppose staff will be saying, you know, there is money there, don't just all spend it on shiny new buildings, we need to have a bit of an investment in our staff after 4 years of below inflation increases.
Indeed. Yeah.
Well, all those figures are published from about page 40, I'll get it right, page 42 this week. You'll be able to look up your own institution, their endowment, their net assets, their net surplus, total staff costs. It's fascinating reading. Before I go, I should flag up there's a second podcast this week as well. I spoke to Dr. Ibrahim Afsar, Associate Professor of Public International Law at the University of Copenhagen, about his MOOC on the history of law in Muslim world. It's available where you found this podcast. But until next week, that's the end of the THE Issue Review. If you want to comment on anything you've heard about or indeed read about in the magazine, you'll find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Google+, and of course at timeshighereducation.co.uk. But that's all for this week's Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.